This one time in New Jersey, I was a kid. As I was growing up, we frequently drove up to Union City from down the shore to see my grandparents, cousins, uncles, aunts, and of course, the quote, aunts, uncles, and cousins. The extended Italian-American family can get confusing with a tree that has as many imaginary and dotted lines as it does solid. As we drove up the parkway and my young brain was trying to figure out just who it was that we were about to see, whether related or related-ish, my mental focus was always being drawn back to the meal that was already being prepared. Most Sundays, I could count on the arrival scene being the same. Sausages and neck bones being browned in the tall pot, the meatballs just about being done fried in a separate pan. Paper towel lined countertops. Never quite figured that one out. My grandmother would sneak me a preview meatball in a little bowl. All the meats would then take a nice long bath in the simmering tomato puree and maybe some other stuff. To ask about grandma's recipe or to call this tomato sauce got a kid chased from the kitchen with a hot spoon. It's gravy. And yes, there is a difference. My name is Howie Southworth. I travel, I eat, I cook, and then I write fancy words about all of it. My cookbooks are loaded with wild stories and fabulous bites, and I've shared plenty of my own adventures. But now, I want to hear somebody else's for a change. Sauced in Translation is a timely podcast spanning the globe of food, spinning tales of lavish meals, and epic gastronomic failure. Join us for some well-deserved armchair globetrotting. Let's get saucy. My guest today is Frankie Huang. Frankie is a freelance writer and artist with a list of bylines that far exceeds the length of this podcast. But the short list is notable. The Atlantic, the New York Times, the Guardian, and the Daily Beast is where I would start. It is within these gilded pages that Frankie shares her rather personal and poignant take on topics such as culture, identity, and feminism. Perhaps most importantly, however, and yes, I'm biased, she's also a lover of food. Here's our chat. Frankie, we do not know one another. You are my first guest with whom I do not have an existing relationship, but I feel like I sort of know you. You are unique among Twitterers and writers that I frequent in that you consistently share yourself with the reader. So in a way, I feel like we've already begun many discussions. So I'm just going to jump in the middle. I noticed this morning on Twitter, you asked folks to describe umami. What kind of response did you get?
I got a lot of savory, salty, and then more abstract descriptions like earthy or tawny or thick. The ones that are really interesting are not even taste related. It's people say it's delicious or that it's long lasting and coats the tongue. And it starts to sound more like someone describing, you know, taking ecstasy rather than the umami taste, which I sort of expected, but it's still really entertaining to see what people came up with.
I was most curious when I read the question. It drew out of my mind what I would be answering if it were me typing the answer. So if someone posed the question to you, how do you briefly describe it?
I would describe it like akin to the ocean or oysters or seafood. So definitely there's a saltiness to it, but also that like freshness you get from something that came out of the sea.
The first word that popped into my mind when I thought about it was funk.
Ooh.
But there's a fulfilling thing that goes on with seafood that I think can be nailed down as funk, but maybe it's like a briny funk or like an oceanic funk. There's something there. Like if I think of miso, that's not oceanic at all, but it's got that funk. You know, sun-dried tomatoes have a funky earthiness maybe.
You know, the word funk makes me think of stinky feet, unfortunately, which is, I guess, good for certain cheeses, but I generally think funk is stinky.
By the way, interestingly enough, did you know that the bacteria that forms naturally between toes is the same bacteria that grows in many cheeses?
I would like to remove that information from my brain.
Like others during this weird time, you either went through phases where you started cooking something and only that for a while and then moved on to something else. There was people that went through a sourdough phase and then a banana bread phase and then a chicken tikka masala phase, if you're me. Is there something that you can identify that you've gotten into and wanted to perfect that you hadn't perfected in the past?
Yeah, I think the steamed bun, like pork buns that I've been playing with and making is something that I want to get right. and to a lesser extent, roasted chicken. I'm not much of a meat eater. Like I like it, but I don't need it. But for the buns, I was always really intimidated by yeast in the past, by, you know, leavened dough. It's a little gross, like the smell of the yeast. Like when you punch down and like gas flies out of the dough, it's a little gross to me. But my dad sort of put the intimidation in my head early on because he used to make mantou, like steamed buns. He liked to use baking soda to leaven the dough instead of yeast. And he, for some reason, was not precise about the amount of flour and baking soda he used. So of course, it resulted in a lot of buns that were yellow or tasted like baking soda. And he was always like fiddling with the temperature or the length of time that he left the dough for. So he made it seem like this really volatile science. But then, you know, I actually went on YouTube and watched tutorials and realized actually just measure everything and like watch the size. And, you know, you kind of know what you're doing. So.
Boy, it is chemistry, right? I mean, at the end of the day, baking is, well, in this case, steaming, but pastries of whatever ilk, it is all chemistry. Your childhood baozi and mantou, were they cakey in that case? Baking soda acts differently than yeast.
It was a little bit firmer. It's been a while, but the yellow and the baking soda taste stayed with me because those were like wrong.
So after you started making them with yeast, you're like, wow, this is amazing.
I don't know what my dad was doing. He was like, he was rigged for failure, basically.
So listeners be damned. I'm going to get into the weeds about baozi with you because I love the format of the steamed bun that are filled specifically. There's a pantheon of steamed buns. Are you working on pork, other meat? Are you working on soupy, not soupy? What are you specifically looking for as you're working?
Yeah, so I'm sticking with the mostly northern Western tradition of like fluffy big baozi. I like soup dumplings, but I want to just leave it to the professionals. I like to have like a little steamer brought to me and I just eat it. I've watched videos. It's a lot of work. I like making pork buns, you know, very traditional pork and scallion. I've also done a veggie one with glass noodles with carrots and chives and eggs. That one is good.
That sounds good.
There's also one that's beef and a glass noodle. That one's really nice too. It's a little juicier. Oh, I've also done a pork and dill, which is also a filling I really like. It's kind of a northern Chinese flavor that it's not the most popular. So you don't find it at all the restaurants, but it's really, really good.
I've been to Xi'an a number of times, but in recent trips, I don't know if this has anything to do with my not finding them before or just the timing of things being faddish or not faddish, but the combination specifically, and you mentioned pork and dill, that combination within a pancake, a dumpling, a bao. I've noticed that there's an increase in that specific combination, which is wacky that you're mentioning it now.
I think pork and dill is probably my favorite.
Have you done the fermented cabbage and scrambled egg?
Oh, Suntai, I forgot about that one. I also really like fermented cabbage and pork. I've eaten that in dumplings more. Mm-hmm. And actually, I couldn't find the right cabbage, so I swapped in sauerkraut, and it actually worked perfectly.
What is sauerkraut but funky cabbage? Do you remember your last journey and what you ate?
My last big trip before the pandemic was actually to Melbourne, to Australia. And I ate kangaroo for my birthday.
Wow. Can you relate it to any other meat?
It's like lean steak. It's a red meat. It tastes like beef. It doesn't really have like a gamey flavor to it. You know, like mutton has a very strong scent that and an aftertaste. You know, kangaroo is just kind of like tough steak. I can see why it's not super mainstream. It's like a novelty meat that you try, but nothing really to write home about. It was fine.
I'm thinking if someone asked me and I didn't know and that person didn't know, I would assume that kangaroo tastes a lot like venison, maybe because it's the same hair color. I have no idea why I make the relation.
I had venison, but I don't remember what it tastes like.
Huh. I think it tastes like kangaroo. What was the best thing that you put in your mouth in Australia?
So I went to one of a big open air market with a lot of stalls, and there was a oyster truck. Well, it was like a seafood truck. So there were oysters and mussels, and I got, you know, steamed mussels in white wine and crusty bread. And it was just really fresh, really good.
Yeah. You could swap out that soup with anything. And the mussels and the shells turn whatever liquid that is into gold.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less there. It becomes, a lot of umami. Very funky. Woohoo. It makes it less about the meat of the mussels and more about dunking that bread. Am I wrong? Yeah. Oh my God. That's the best. So the best. We have a couple of places in DC that do, you know, a number of different broths. And it is an interesting study to go down that rabbit hole and try to order, you know, six or seven different across the people at the table. And so you can taste those different effects of the shells in the broth. But I can understand why that would be a highlight bite. Let me ask you a question, Frankie. Do you have a favorite travel food story?
So one that was really good was from 2 years ago. I was taking a trip through Rajasthan in India with a good friend of mine and her boyfriend at the time. So they're both locals and they speak multiple Indian languages. And it's really helpful for getting around because I'm not stuck in like a tourist area where people spoke English. So instead of, you know, going to these tourist trap restaurants, my friend's boyfriend asked one of the auto rickshaw drivers to, you know, take us to a nice place where, you know, he likes to go. We were in Jodhpur at the time. And we went away from like the pretty blue area and drove around in these like narrow streets. I had no idea where we were. And we went to this stall where it's just a bunch of other drivers parked there. They were having grilled meat. There were these giant pots of, you know, stuff. I can't really tell you what it was. And I don't know exactly what I had, but, you know, we just hopped out and went over and my friends went and got us a bunch of stuff and everything was amazing. And it was a pleasure to be taken away from the experience I would have been limited to had I been alone and, you know, get a taste for local flavors as locals would enjoy it. And I think that's the kind of thing that I'm always looking for. But, you know, there are always limitations too when you're traveling. If you don't have the right person with you who's, you know, in the right spirit, you're going to miss it. Like I was with these two hipster young people that don't really want to spend money on luxuries. They kind of want to look for something authentic, and it worked out really well.
Well, I think that the magic happens when not only you have willing and good guides like you had, like the two that you were with, they sound like they knew what they were doing. And even if they didn't know what they were doing, you had to ask a cab driver and say, hey, these guys always know what they're doing with food. Where should we go? But the other side of that same coin is the traveler, like in you in this case, you have to be willing to just kind of hand over your soul for a little bit and to say, look, I know it's going to be amazing. And even if it's not, it's a better story, right? Mm-hmm. Let's go for it. Take me to where you're going to go. Give me whatever food you're going to give. I had a similar experience. I went to a Bengali place, which I had never been specifically to a Bengali style restaurant in Singapore, in Little India. And it was that type of thing where I actually felt an awkwardness because I literally had to take a deep breath and say, okay, I am now handing myself over. And I just tell the server, my wife and I both were just like, give us what you got. You know, we don't know this cuisine. We'd like to get to know it. And here we go. And so I find that specifically Indian and Indian-like banquets or big meals are always such a festival for the eyes and the nose and the ears.
Another favorite, long time ago, actually, it's in 2011. I went to Yunnan with three of my girlfriends. We just finished language program in Beijing, so we were gonna do some traveling. We had this idea that we really wanted to stay in one of those guest houses that's in the middle of the rice paddies. So it was the wrong season to see the tiered paddies, you know, without the crops growing out of them. But you know, they're still there. And actually, they were still really beautiful. And we found, like, I scoured the internet looking for listings for a hotel because I was the only person who was really fluent in Chinese. And I found this, honestly, like, really sketchy looking hotel for an old lady who ran a guest house. But we had a good feeling about it. We were sort of very carefree. We were like, let's just go with it. And, you know, when we arrived, it was a very simple cement structure. We had these very dinky rooms that were full of mosquitoes and it was super cold at night. But she was really nice. Like she reminded me of my own grandmother. She was just really no nonsense, quick on her feet, old biddy. She had this giant kitchen full of like bottled water bottles that had like condiments in them. You know, her woks and her knives were all over the place. And that's, you know, the only place we were going to get food basically while we were staying there. And, you know, my girlfriends were a little bit nervous. They were rich, you know, they're used to like finer things. They were kind of disappointed that I booked them like a dump without any amenities. But yeah, the lady was just like, you know, make sure, just tell me what you want and I'll make it for you. And we didn't know what to make of it. And my girlfriends went to like a little corner store nearby and bought like biscuits. They were just going to tough it out. The grandma got really angry at us. And she made us this like really elaborate meal. Really, like, I wasn't there to watch it, unfortunately, but you know, there were fresh vegetables. There were like soups. She made a fried rice. Like, I don't know how she was able to make all of that at the time. I mean, now I kind of get it because I can also whip together a meal. But the highlight of that meal was fresh pig's liver that she got from a butcher on that morning. The pig was killed. She brought home this, like, it might have been warm still. She was just like, this is wonderful. Like, nothing beats fresh liver stir-fried with onions. And it was incredible. It was so tender and so good. My girlfriends didn't eat any of it because they were just like, ew, intestines. Yeah, that was one of the best meals I've ever had.
And oddly enough, you gave me the opposite story, but not about you, about your friends, where they did not give over their soul to the grandma who was running that place. I have a question. So I'm going to guess that you were you in Yuanyang, or were you in some other town in that valley?
I was in Yuanyang.
There, what your experience is a story that I completely relate to, number one, and tend to tell when someone asks about Yunnan food specifically. And it's a large majority of the restaurants, if they're not built for tourists, which means they're going to serve all kinds of cuisine from all over China, most of them are going to sell you on Sichuan food because it's very popular, right? Yeah. But if you're looking for Yunnan style cooking, I'm finding that it's mostly common to walk into even a formal restaurant where they have refrigerators full of ingredients. Mm-hmm. And it's a discussion between you and the server, mm-hmm. or you and the cook, and probably maybe the same person, where you're like, okay, we want some of the gourds, and we want the cabbage, and this pork liver looks fantastically fresh. And they say, great, how do you want that cooked? Stir fried with some garlic and throw in whatever else you want. I'm finding that the Yunnan cooks are much more, they want to cook what you want to eat rather than here's our menu.
Yeah.
Choose some foods. They're like, either put me in your hands and I'll cook whatever I want and it's going to be great. Or here's my stuff. It's what we bought at the market this morning. What do you want? Yeah. It's so funny because I've never heard, and nobody else has ever told me that type of story from that specific set of places.
I've had that experience in Xiamen as well. And I think some other places too, where whether it's in front of a restaurant, they have like baskets of whatever they have. And you just point to, you know, what you want and tell them how you want it cooked. Or, you know, places with seafood, especially, you point to like, I want that fish. I want you to kill it in front of me.
Yeah. And they'll do it. In Yuanyang, we went there in April. I'm not sure what month you were there.
I went in August.
In August. Okay. So this was just before the green season for the rice. So April, but there weren't that many tourists in the town. In Yuanyang, this town is very touristy at different parts of the year. We stayed in a similar kind of guest house that was all concrete. But the water was only on, because it wasn't the season, water was only on an hour and a half a day or something like this. And so we didn't know that. And we didn't think to ask that. So we go to take showers and they're like, oh no, well, you have to take showers between 1 and 2:30 PM. We're like, okay, really? That's when everybody's out. Yeah. But we had that same kind of off-season terrace experience. We went from Yuanyang to a small town called Luchun. Mm-hmm. And Luchun was a podunk backwoods, very much a laboring town where the terraces were even more beautiful than Yuanyang, mm-hmm. and there were no tourists. And so we had restaurants like that that would cook whatever you want and a great rice paddy terrace experience because there was nobody around. So where it was just the beginning of the planting season, a lot of people were working with their feet wet, dropping in the, what do they call the seedlings? Dropping in the rice seedlings and working with the oxen walking down the middle of the sidewalk, pushing you out of the way.
Oh yeah. I biked by the highway and we had to like go around flocks of sheep.
Oh yeah. And that's not uncommon. Did you drive from or get driven, however you transferred from Kunming to wherever you ended up?
We took a shuttle, like a big bus. It might have been a sleeper.
I would have been terrified on some of those roads.
Oh, yeah.
In a sleeper
bus. Shangri-La after Yuanyang. And, you know, it's like winding up the mountain.
Oh.
I had a window seat, so there were times I'm just like, wow, that is a cliff.
Uh-huh.
I am on a cliff.
You're on a cliff and there's no guardrail.
No.
And the hairpin turns. So we got driven from Xishuangbanna, very down by Thailand.
Yeah, on the border.
Right on the border. It's actually an interesting border because you're near Thailand, Myanmar, and Laos, I think. Anyway, so it's right there. It's this triangle of, it's actually a very high trafficked drug border.
The Golden Triangle.
And we were on that same road that you took from Yuanyang up to Shangri-La, only we were going through small towns all the way back up to Kunming. Mm. And let me tell you something, white knuckle trip the whole way. And I would have felt worse in a bus or a sleeper. We were in a SUV and we thought we were going to die. And just in case it was the end, I bought a bag of baozi that morning. And they were purple mushrooms, which down in Yunnan, there's all kinds of mushrooms. But these were dark purple, and I'll never forget the hue of them. It was like a beet. Okay, Frankie, I'm going to turn the tables and ask you if you have a worst travel food story.
I think this was in 2012. I went to San Francisco for the first time because, you know, I mostly grew up on the East Coast, and I was in Chicago for school. And I had an airline credit from giving up my seat one day. And so I just wanted to, I don't know, go see the sights or something.
Bonus.
Yeah. So I went to San Francisco, which in Chinese, one of its older names in Chinese is Jiujinshan, the old gold mountain, which is very romantic, I think. Despite the, you know, hardship that name also implies. But anyways, I went to San Francisco. I know there are a lot of, you know, Chinese American culture. My mom had a friend out there, so I was staying with this auntie for a few days, and she wanted to take me to see the Chinatown. And, you know, it made sense. I wanted to see history, and I didn't expect it to look so kitschy. It was like a, you know, amusement park with an explosion of, you know, Chinese-esque decorations. It felt very fake. I didn't really expect it, but then I thought, well, you know, it makes sense for local Chinese diaspora to sort of self-orientalize because this is what, you know, local white people perhaps wanted to see. And it's all about survival. It's fine. You know, I'm not the whoever they cater to. The thing that I'll never forget was we were hungry and we decided to get some dim sum because I thought, well, it's mostly Cantonese people in this area, so the dim sum must be pretty good. So we just walked into a random shop. There weren't that many people in there, and we just ordered some classic dim sum dishes like radish cake, hargao, you know, all of that. And, you know, the staff weren't really that friendly, and we were the only people in there. The food they brought out was the worst Chinese food I've eaten in my entire life. It was probably the only time I didn't finish all my food. I always try to finish all my food because even if I don't love it, I don't normally hate anything. But I just remember the flavor of the shrimp in the hargao. There was something wrong, like something was dying or I was dying. I'm not really sure. The wrappers were so thick that I don't even know how to describe it. It was really chewy. It was hard to break apart. It was wrong. Everything was wrong. We ended up giving up and leaving. And afterwards, a friend of mine said, you probably were in a restaurant that was a front for, you know, organized crime. And, you know, they weren't really expecting people to come in to eat. And that's why it was so bad. But I was like, maybe. I mean, that food was like not fit for consumption. So if it was indeed a front and I wasn't supposed to eat there, well, at least that makes sense.
That's a really good point. I wouldn't have immediately gotten there. But if you're in there and it's around a mealtime and there's nobody else, yeah, start running or something, right? Or now you know, right? You have a cautionary tale. There is a bar called the Buddha Bar, and it was on California Street, just at the edge of Chinatown. And back when I was back when you had to go in person to get a visa to go to China every year, if you wanted to, they'd have no such thing as a 10-year unlimited visa. It was a, you know, per trip. Buddha Bar was across the street from the consulate. And so me and my friend went across the street to the Buddha Bar. And it was, again, another one of these things where there was nobody in the bar, that there was no bathroom on the ground level. I should have known better than to descend a staircase. Because that was the first time I had ever run it. This was back in 1997 or something like this, 1999. I never ran into this in my life. I descend the stairs and it was a legit gambling hall. I had never seen this in my life. And I had been in Chinatown time and time and time again. And by the way, I asked to go down to the bathroom and they opened a gate to let me down. How was I not going to be freaked out? Anyway, we couldn't run out of there quickly enough until my friend Greg realized that he put down a $50 bill for two beers. And I came up the stairs. I was like, we're out of here. Come on, get. He's like, a block away. I gave them a 50. I was like, yeah, okay, they own that 50 now.
But what was it like? What was the gambling hall like?
It's what you imagine. It was plain walls, plain wood tables, bunch of guys, and a big cloud of smoke. And all the guys had like the white tank tops on. It was summer, shorts and white tank tops, their bellies exposed, the Beijing belly, right? And it was no air conditioning. It was hotter than Hades. It was cacophonous, but it's the movie scene that you see when someone happens upon a Chinese or a Chinatown gambling hall.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was fascinating, but not as fascinating as someone who had to put a horrible hargao in their mouth only to realize that it was probably a front for the same thing. Time for our five fill in the blanks, if you are ready, Frankie.
Sure.
Blank will be my last meal.
Hainan chicken rice.
That was fast.
Hainan chicken rice is just perfect comfort food. It's filling, but it's not, it doesn't stuff me. There's rice and vegetable and chicken. You can like mix it up and dip. I mean, it's like a fun experience to eat. And I don't know, it's just really good. It's good in the winter because it's a little spicy, and it's good in the summer because it's cold. Yeah, it's just it's a perfect meal.
And you're right. I didn't think about the fact that it really would be nice in the summertime as well as the warming of the spice, because it is like that cold, beautiful dish. And actually, and
it comes with a warm chicken soup as well. And I actually really like drinking hot soup in the summer, and you know, you get really sweaty, and then afterwards it's really refreshing because I don't know, it feels like a little detox, and then you can have like a cold beverage and it's just really nice.
Well, it cools you down. Mm-hmm. It cools you down.
Yeah.
My favorite part, I guess the rice is also delicious because of how it cooks. Yeah. But my favorite part of Hainanese chicken rice is the skin and the subcutaneous layer of fat. Mm-hmm. That becomes the texture, and no one ever believes this, but when you have it done right, and you sound like you've had it done right, that layer becomes like butter. Mm-hmm. It becomes like the skin has a like an immediate snap that just gives, but that layer of fat is like butter. Mm-hmm. And most cooks, most mortals don't know how to achieve that.
Yeah.
So when you have a good one, you know it's a good one.
Yeah, I miss it a lot.
Well, maybe that's your next obsession. Maybe that's what you're going to go after next.
Oh my goodness. Maybe.
Next one. I cook blank to impress people.
Pot sticker dumplings.
I cook blank to comfort myself.
These days, it's fried rice. Egg fried rice with scallion. It would only be day-old rice with egg, scrambled egg, basically, and fried scallion. That's it.
Really?
Yeah, very simple.
Simple, but gorgeous.
Although, I don't always have day-old rice lying around. So if I want to make something comforting for myself and I don't have anything lying around, it's probably, I can't remember the name of it now, but it's the pasta dish where it's fried, you fry the garlic and then you add the chopped parsley later.
So aglio olio?
Yes, that one.
Lovely. There's just basic alchemy. It's a really, that's a really sweet dish.
Yeah.
Tomato and egg. That's my go-to comfort food. If no one else is around, love nice. Fanchia Chodan. That is the best.
That's good stuff.
Because
I have to ask you, how do you make it? Like the steps?
Controversially, that's how. I use olive oil. So
that's fine.
So I am a simplistic tomato and egg maker, because the way that I quote grew up with it in my 20s in China was too much oil, too hot. Scramble that egg quick. Dump it out into a bowl.
Yeah.
More oil, but not too much oil this time. Wedged tomatoes. Mm-hmm. High heat, saute about a minute till it starts to lose its pulp. Mm-hmm. Soy sauce.
Yep.
5 minutes until it reduces.
5 minutes.
Hold on. Mm-hmm. That soy sauce has to reduce. Mm. The flavor difference between just soy sauce out of the bottle and reduced soy sauce, like by half, is immense. But what it does to the egg when you then reintroduce it, it coats the egg in dark red gravy, which is what I'm after. But I'm also, you know, I can claim to do the absurd because my grandmother didn't make it. My mother didn't make it, right?
I never really try to make traditional things. I respect it, but I don't really come from any sacred cooking traditions. I kind of just make whatever I want. Mm-hmm.
That's the way it should be. If you could erase one food from the earth, it would be blank.
I don't think I hate anything that much, but I may remove durian from myself. I know a lot of people love it, but it's very stinky. I'm not a fan.
Having been presented with just market after market of durian and one sliced open, whoa, scary. But that's the same way that some people approach stinky tofu. They can't walk within a block of it.
I don't really like stinky tofu that much either.
But please don't get rid of it because I love it. And last but certainly not least, blank is for dinner tonight.
I'm making 红烧茄子. Mm-hmm. So braised eggplant.
And red cooked specifically. So the star anise and the cinnamon and like all that stuff, the Shaoxing wine and...
Probably going to cut back on the anise because my husband is not a fan. But yeah, you know.
Yep. What's your first step in cooking it? Are you a big fan of the deep fried eggplant and then braising it? Is that what you do?
I'm actually trying something new tonight because I've been using the oven a lot to make a lot of different things. I'm actually going to toss or brush, I haven't decided yet, the cut up eggplant in oil and popping it in the oven at 425 for, I don't know, 25 minutes and see what happens.
I'm an advocate of this idea. Last night, in fact, I was making eggplant parmesan, so totally different application. However, I sliced it thick because you're going to do a roll cut or something like that, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I used an Italian eggplant and I cut it into thick slices, but the philosophy might still work. I oiled it and salted it and I broiled it. Mm-hmm. It was about 3/4 inch thick slices. Yeah. And I broiled it for about 4 minutes on either side at about 2 inches below the broiler. Mm. That seemed to seize up the skin enough. Ooh. So that later on, I braised it in tomato sauce. I didn't want to deep fry anything. It worked like a charm. And so I don't know. I've never tried it with red cooked, but what you're doing in the traditional way of deep frying the eggplant is you're seizing the outside so that the sauce doesn't actually absorb into it and make it fall apart. I wonder if broiling it would work because roasting it, the warning that I have for you is that roasting it for too long at a medium temperature, 350, 375, it will fall apart. Mm-hmm. But what you want to do for red cook, you want to avoid that. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have to take my advice. Tell me to jump off a bridge. But it might work if you broil it at a very high temperature.
I will take that under consideration.
Promise me you let me know if you did it or lie to me and tell me you did it.
Okay.
Well, so this has been nice. I do, in fact, feel like I deserve to know how the eggplant comes out. And I would love to see photographs.
You know me. I'm always putting food pictures on Twitter. But if I don't, it's probably because it failed. So don't like call me out on it. No, I like to talk about my kitchen adventures.
Yes. And so I will continue to read your brilliance. And I thank you for your time. I know that you're not a slothful person and are quite busy.
Yeah, this was really fun. Thank you for inviting me.
Not a problem. And until next time, bye.
Bye.
To all of you wonderful, intelligent listeners out there, remember to subscribe to this show, follow me on Instagram, and find our books with your favorite seller. Those are One Pan to Rule Them All, Kiss My Casserole, How to Cook Anything in Your Dutch Oven, Chinese Street Food, and the forthcoming Off the Top of My Head, Recipes, Rants, and Ravings of an American Cook Obsessing in Barcelona. Until next time, stay saucy and eat well.